From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Krolat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis joins me to discuss last weekend's failed coup attempt in Turkey. Hundreds of people died during the uprising, and tens of thousands were arrested during this week's crackdown.
Turkey is suffering, and this is a sign of Turkish weakness. To become more authoritarian is only going to weigh on U.S.-Turkish relations in the future.
Then I'll talk with Ed Wright. Ever since the 2004 tsunami, he's been trying to make sure Indonesia is prepared for another catastrophe.
We make a map of the community, come up with areas which are, you know, topographically higher, so they're the safe places to stay. And then we even run like simulation disasters.
My conversation with the Southeast Asia representative for World Neighbors right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolat. Joshua Landis, welcome back to the roundtable. It's been a while. It's been a long summer.
It has been. It's great to be here.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you back. And it's good to be back in the studio for me. So we're going to talk Turkey today because obviously a week ago there was what appears to be a failed coup attempt in Turkey. There's a lot of speculation. We're not entirely sure what's happened here. At least maybe you can enlighten us a little bit about what has happened here. But it seems to be that the Gulenists maybe were being blamed for this, but now we're not sure. Maybe it was something that was orchestrated by the Erdogan regime. Anyway, give us the scoop on what happened here. We know it was a failed attempt, or at least that's what we've been told. What are some of the details? What do we need to know about the coup in Turkey?
Well, a military attempted coup with lots of mid-level military guys, but also many generals. One-third of all Turkish generals have now been separated from the military. 60,000 people have been fired, arrested, or pushed out of their jobs. This is a major house cleaning that's going on.
60,000 people in the military alone
or across other
government agencies?
Over 2,000 judges. Over 2,000 judges, many deans, so you're lucky you're not a Turk. And lots of professors. There has been a long slate of public enemies, of enemies of the Erdogan regime that have been pushed out. And this isn't people who are connected to the coup. This is a very opportunistic sweep.
But give us your best understanding here of, was this a real coup attempt?
Yes, this was a real coup attempt.
And was it orchestrated by – who was it orchestrated by?
We don't know.
A military thing, or we still don't know?
We don't know. The Gulenist organization, as you pointed out, as you mentioned, has been accused by President Erdogan of being behind this coup. The Gulenist movement is a religious movement, liberal.
Secular, meaning secular. Is that what you
mean?
No,
it's not secular. It's a religious movement. But it's for democracy, it's for good relations with the West, and the West has been very intrigued with this movement because Fethullah Gulen, who is a resident in Pennsylvania for the last 20 years, is accused of masterminding this coup. And this is going to undermine U.S. and Turkish relations. It could undermine them even further because there is an extradition demand for him. And a package just the other day was sent to Washington demanding that he be expelled. And the U.S. is going to have to go through it, but it's going to be very difficult. And the U.S. doubts whether there's proper evidence. At any rate.
Nor will this person probably get a fair trial or any sort of, you know, real justice if he was to be returned to Turkey. So, I mean, obviously there's you know, an incredible heavy hand that's operating
in Turkey today.
And some say that this is working to Erdogan's advantage, right? The sense that he's able to clean house. I mean, is this going to continue or
this will is a real move towards authoritarianism. This is a real move towards authoritarianism, and it has everybody very worried. And this has been going on for some time. Now, we have to remember that Erdogan was an extremely popular leader of Turkey and still is a popular leader of Turkey. He engineered an about-face for Turkey that was extremely important, a big economic boom, and that is what really cemented him. But he also became what many people held up and President Obama held up in the first years of his presidency as the exemplar of a liberal Islamist who could bring democracy to Turkey, who could make the economy boom. And Turkey was 17th largest economy in the world, 7th largest in Europe. He stopped inflation. He helped balance the books to a certain degree and led a very good foreign policy, zero enemies foreign policy, as it was called by his Secretary of State, which was to make friends with Russia, Syria, Armenians, Greeks, everybody.
Well, they are right there in the middle of everybody. I mean, this is really important for them, this kind of foreign policy. Yeah.
Precisely. They were going to take advantage of that entrepreneurial position. Now, all that fell apart with the beginning of the Syrian civil war, which he got dragged into. And this began to splinter Turkey, dividing secularists from Islamists, dividing Kurds from Turks, dividing Shiites from Sunnis. So it put tremendous strain on society inside Turkey. And that has fed, I think, some of the divisions. But the war between Kurds and Turks has begun again. So Turkey is suffering. And this is a sign of Turkish weakness. And a crackdown to become more authoritarian by Erdogan is only going to weigh on U.S.-Turkish relations in the future.
Well, I think the point that Turkey is suffering and that this is all a consequence of that is in some ways a really important point, because clearly the migrant crisis and all of the wars on near their borders and within their borders with the Kurds is really taking its toll. And so the response clearly is to be heavy-handed. But this economic issue, I mean, he's credited with this economic turnaround, but this is going to have a huge and devastating effect on Turkey economically.
It is. And you look at our programs, Little University of Oklahoma, which was – I was supposed to be teaching a class in Turkey, taking 20 students. That was canceled. But setting up a center potentially in Turkey, all of that is now on hold. And if our university is doing that, think of big business. Foreign investment is going to come to a standstill, and Turkish middle class is going to get hammered.
And the tourist industry is completely dried up. So it's really devastating for Turkey in so many ways. We're going to keep watching this, Joshua, as always, and we'll talk about it again, undoubtedly. Thank you for being here today.
Pleasure.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldviews section of our website or send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. I'm on social media at Suzek Rolat. And you can follow all of Joshua's thoughts on the Middle East at Joshua_Landis. While you're at KGOU.org, you can also listen to all of our past shows, read our digital content, and subscribe to our podcast. Coming up, I'll talk about development in Sudan and Indonesia with Ed Wright from the organization World Neighbors. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. My guest this half hour is Ed Wright. Since 2012, he's served as the Southeast Asia representative for World Neighbors, where he focuses on climate change adaptation and sustainable agriculture. He's also worked on disaster risk reduction in Indonesia ever since the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami. More than 200,000 people died, and billions of dollars in aid were distributed throughout the region. Ed Wright, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Ed, you're originally from Wales. You hold degrees in human rights law, but you currently live and work in Indonesia. Most people don't realize how large Indonesia actually is, a very populous country, a Muslim country, obviously composed of numerous islands. Mm. You mentioned the Boxing Day, the day after Christmas tsunami following the earthquake back in 2004, mm-hmm. Where it was just devastating, of course, to many mm-hmm. in the region. But that's one of the things that you work on, and I think one of the things that a country like Indonesia really struggles with, and that is how to manage natural disasters. And what mm-hmm. to do, you know, how to reduce the risk of being victimized by natural disasters. Okay. So what is some of the work that you do in Indonesia to mm-hmm. address that?
So this really is the main focus of our work at the moment. So it's called disaster risk reduction, and we work mainly at the village level. So we would first work with the government to identify which villages are most at risk from disasters. Then we do like a broad participatory needs-based assessment. And from that assessment, then you categorize each of the different type of disasters which the community has faced. For example, in the last 10 years, they've had 3 droughts. They've had, 5 earthquakes. And then you'd categorize the damage caused. And then you would be able to calculate their vulnerability and their capacity to deal with that risk. And so then once we have this assessment, we're able to come up, everything's very participatory. We come up with an action plan about how we can reduce their vulnerability and increase their capacity. And so that action plan, that's the document which guides our work then for the next 2-3 years. At the community level, then they have a management group who's responsible to the community for implementing that action plan. And then as world neighbors, we're there to build this group's capacity.
What are some of the specific things, though, that you do to build capacity to be able to, let's say, be able to, survive floods and protect their agriculture? It's an agricultural area. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the things
suggest? Like we would introduce crops which are more drought resistant or flood resistant. Then we would, we make a map of the community and work with the community on evacuation routes, come up with areas which are, topographically higher, so they're the safe places to stay. We put them in contact with the government search and rescue team. And then we even run like simulation disasters. So the whole community would come together for the day. We work together with the Red Cross. And then the government's disaster management unit, and we'd run through a simulation. And then so that in this community management group, as I said earlier, people have different roles. So one would be involved, so a group of people would be involved like the first response. Another group would be involved in contacting the hospitals, making sure there's paramedics on hand. Another group would have received training in like trauma counseling. That's the type of activities we do.
So speaking of crops and the kind of agriculture products that Indonesia produces, mm-hmm. We're very familiar, I think, with coffee as being one of their primary products, but it's not the only one. What else are they producing there that they do need to manage in terms of the weather? I mean, we don't realize how much, the weather really has an impact on agricultural areas, such as in Indonesia, which is, an equatorial region and therefore has some fluctuating weather.
Yeah. The main crops are paddy, so rice, and then corn. The areas where we work is mostly corn, because we work mostly with rural upland communities, so it's quite difficult, quite risky to grow rice because you need a lot of water. But where we work in, we're trying to introduce local crops. We call it local crops rather than like this monocrop like corn or rice. Local crops are more like cassava or sweet potato, and then, papaya, bananas, and local corn rather than the hybrid corn that they're growing, because these crops are more resistant to climate change, so they can deal with, fluctuating weather, because the main impact from climate change in these communities is erratic rainfall. Like, up till 10, 15 years ago, it was quite, the rains would come when they always had. But now recently, the wet season should start, November, December, and now it's starting January, February, and it's, finishing March or April. It used to finish in January, but so it's a lot shorter, but it's a lot more intense. And so you need crops which are able to deal most of the year with very little rainfall, but then still can be harvested when there's a downpour.
So obviously guiding them, working with them to develop sustainable farming practices that will work with, as you mentioned, climate change. So clearly the climate is changing for Indonesia, as you just mentioned, the rainy season changing, being shorter, starting later. So what are some of the things, in addition to just helping them produce the right crops for climate change? Mm-hmm. I mean, that really changes a lot of, the market, and it changes their way of life. But what are some of the other things that they can do, or that you're helping them to do to manage the change in their climate?
Mm-hmm. Most of the places where we work it's really subsistence farming, so they're not really connected to the markets yet. But we would, you know, a lot of them are still, we try and use organic fertilizer wherever we can. And this is fertilizer which, you know, the farmers can produce themselves. So that really keeps the nutrients in the soil, because if you use chemical fertilizer, it's good for growing a crop fast, but after 2-3 years, the soil's really degraded. And so rather than, you know, this slash and burn agriculture, which maybe was in the news recently because of the huge smog problems across Southeast Asia, we try and introduce terracing and contour farming, and these are soil and water conservation techniques. So the farmer doesn't have to keep moving around looking for better, like new soil, because the soil's already degraded. He's able to use the same piece of land for many, many years. So we do soil water conservation, terracing, contour farming, and also agroforestry, because agroforestry is intercropping crops together with trees. And so trees are excellent nutrient providers. And so we'd have like maybe a row of coffee and then like a row of trees. And this really keeps the soil fertile, makes the crops grow better. And also after 10, 15 years, the community is able to cut the trees and sell them as wood. So it's a livelihood project as well.
My guest is Ed Wright, the Southeast Asia representative for World Neighbors. We'll talk more about his earlier work in Africa right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I'm joined by Ed Wright, the Southeast Asia representative for the international development organization World Neighbors. When we left off, he described some of the agriculture techniques he's tried to apply to Indonesia in order to mitigate climate change and future natural disasters. So your discussion about having to perhaps move around a little bit, doing subsistence farming, but moving around to find the right soil makes me think of Sudan. Your work in Sudan would be relevant here. Can you just tell us a little bit about the having worked in development in both areas, I would presume in some of the same issue areas, on some of the same issue areas, that you can make some comparison to the two countries? Similar issues that they're dealing with? I mean, we talk often about climate change being a big problem in Sudan as well, desertification in that case, where they're losing arable land and farming land, grazing land, so that this has led to a significant amount of war and conflict in Sudan, like perhaps other issues have led to civil war in Indonesia. I mean, were there any lessons you've learned from one place to the other that are generalizable, perhaps?
In South Sudan, I was a water and sanitation manager. So I was managing a program where water sanitation was really, it was like a peace building tool. So we would build a borehole between two communities. There's a bit of a conflict over water scarcity. So we would meet with the communities, decide where, you know, strategic place for the borehole will go. And, you know, and then we would drill it, and then we would provide a lot of capacity building around conflict resolution, because that was my background as well. It was really a lot more response-based, whereas in Indonesia, we're building more of a building the resilience. So we've moved further along, say, the development spectrum. In South Sudan, it was totally devastated. When I was there just before independence and during independence. So it was being devastated by this, you know, 2-decade-long civil war. And so we were really providing the humanitarian response, whereas in Indonesia, the communities where we work in, the poverty levels are very, very high, but it's a development project. It's not a response. So we're building their resilience rather than providing material aid. Because World Neighbors, this is our focus, is that we don't come along to hand out materials or equipment. We really build the capacity which is already there. Whereas in South Sudan, we were really a service provider because the government was basically non-existent at the time.
It is interesting, though, to think about, as you mentioned, your organization building resilience and building capacity, such an important aspect of development. But conflict and war over resources getting in the way of the ability to build capacity and build resilience. Mm-hmm. There's so much to overcome. Like you said, you're responding to these crises. Mm-hmm. So some of the work that you did in terms of, you mentioned that in Sudan you were working in a post-conflict mm-hmm. zone, you know, where there was conflict yeah. over things like, mm-hmm. you know, or scarcity to water. So, I mean, what are some of the activities that you did? What did you do? I'm like, okay. I can't even imagine going into an environment like that mm-hmm. and saying, okay, we're going to work out, you know, your mm-hmm. your access to water here in order to respond to your crisis and conflict.
Yeah. For example, so in South Sudan, you have a lot of pastoralists, and so they don't have sedimentary homesteads. So they spend a lot, like the whole year, moving. And then often they come into conflict with other people because everybody is walking, like, you don't move into unarable areas. Everybody wants to go when the land is very underdeveloped. People normally congregate around water holes or where the soil is good. And so often different tribes would come into conflict with each other, different ethnicities. So one of the things we did, we were building reservoirs. We call them hafias, I think. And this is with a huge hole in the ground when it was a rainwater harvesting. So then when the rains come, the water would be stored there for a few months. So then it would stop communities from entering into each other's land. So that was one of the conflict resolution ideas that we had. Also, you know, water is probably the most basic thing. And conflicts would appear in a village where a woman, mostly a woman or a young child, is having to queue for 10 hours a day. And then a big man would come along and go right to the front of the queue and take his water. And so if we're able to cite a borehole, which is, you know, in a more strategic place, and then, you know, the waiting time is lessened, it's a more open area so everyone can see, you know, who's queuing, and it's a more transparent process to get the water. And again, that's just on a small level how, you know, a conflict inside a village could be solved.
Well, such challenging work that you're doing, Ed. Really appreciate you being here to discuss it, and really appreciate the work that you're doing, because it is very difficult, I'm sure, mm-hmm. to work in countries such as this and teach them to manage mm-hmm. their development problems. So thank you very much for being
here. Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Ed Wright. He serves as the representative in Southeast Asia for the international development organization World Neighbors. There's more information on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is part of a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Miranda Wilson prepares our research, and Brian Hartzinski edits our interviews and oversees the digital content. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Corlatt.